You're listening to America's Web Radio Online. Thanks for tuning in.
Good morning. You are once again in the Doctor's Lounge. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchek. Thanks very much for joining us here on America's Web Radio for another episode of the show that gives you, our loyal and valuable listeners, a chance to listen to the conversations that doctors have amongst themselves in doctors' lounges all across America right about now on the East Coast, but probably not quite yet on the West Coast, where my guest, Dr. Beth Haynes, is joining us very kindly at 5 o'clock in the morning. But this is where you're going to hear what we talk about, and this has changed over the years. We used to talk exclusively about interesting patients with each other, because that's fundamentally where a physician's passion lies. But unfortunately, over the last, couple of decades, and it's been a slow, indolent thing. I mean, we talk about what's happened with recent healthcare reform and things, sort of changing that conversation between doctors. But really, it's been going on for much longer than that. And there is no question that the practice of medicine is under siege. Physicians are under siege. And we've talked about this in prior shows. The increasing regulatory burden, the loss of autonomy, we're expected to do more and more with less and less under a greater and greater threat of legal action if we so much as, make one misstep regarding the hundreds of thousands of pages of regulation that dictate and regulate a physician's behavior. But in this show, we talk about different things. This show is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. At the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, we believe that quality of care is not a matter of how many boxes you check on an electronic form. Quality of care is not coming from a bureaucrat that's reviewing your performance data or your outcomes data from hundreds of miles away. Quality of care is not being forced to use a poor quality electronic medical records product that was forced on you by legislative fiat. Quality of care is not using a more cumbersome ICD-10 coding system, which by some ridiculous and ill-conceived hallucinatory miracle is going to make care any better. Quality of care is not centralized healthcare. It's not a top-down system. We believe at the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, the quality of care starts with four things. It starts with a doctor, a patient, of course, a conversation, and then a freedom between that doctor and patient to choose, make the right healthcare choices for that patient, unencumbered by bureaucratic interference, limitations, and regulations. And we believe that the free market can really solve these problems much better than any sort of heavy-handed regulatory structure. And the bottom line is the green shoots are coming, as David Goldhill calls them. The green shoots are coming. They're coming from direct primary care. They're coming from health savings accounts. They're coming from lots of really interesting places. With those thoughts in mind, I think we're going to have a good show today. We're going to have the first two segments at least, maybe longer, with Dr. Beth Haynes, who's with us at 5 a.m. from California. And then we're going to talk about a little bit of health IT, because I'm always going to circle back to that, and talk about the manufactured interoperability crisis. And then at the end of the show, and I urge you to stick around for this in the fourth segment, we need to respond to a very irresponsible, ill-conceived, horrible position paper that was recently published a couple of days ago by the American College of Physicians. So that's where we're going to go, but we're going to lead off with our guest, Dr. Haynes. Beth, thank you so much for being with us at 5 a.m.
Okay, we're here. I'm sure there's many surgeons who have been scrubbing in and getting ready for their surgeries out here on the West Coast. So, I decided to put on my big girl pants and get up.
Well, we certainly do appreciate that. So I think the first thing that you and I are going to talk about is sort of the multiple ways that that physicians are losing their ability to take care of patients. And this kind of circles back to some of the things we're going to talk about in the fourth segment with some of this stuff, this garbage that's in this American College of Physicians paper. But let's go first things first. Go ahead and review what you've recently learned and what's on your mind about loss of physician autonomy.
Well, what's really interesting, there's been some surveys about physician dissatisfaction with their jobs. And more than loss of income, more than administrative hassles, it's really the decreasing autonomy, the impingement upon the professionalism of physicians that has them dissatisfied with their job. And you know what? People talk, I think, about autonomy as physicians wanting to just, you know, be able to make decisions without considering anybody else and be the one in charge. And that's not at all what it's about. It's about being able to use the years of training and of experience that they've developed, their clinical acumen, and being able to apply that judgment, giving advice to patients without having to be second-guessed by bureaucrats, whether they're insurance bureaucrats or government bureaucrats, really wanting to be able to work with the patient directly and unencumbered by all this interference. And it's not like a man in an island, you know. It's really a collaboration with their peers. It's in collaboration with the patients. That's what autonomy professionalism is all about. And it comes with responsibility and accountability, and the doctors know that and are not afraid of that. They welcome the responsibility and the accountability, but want to be able to use their professional judgment directly for the patient without all this interference. And it's a loss of that, this top-down imposition of all these regulations by sometimes they're physicians, most of the time they're not, but it doesn't matter. Whoever is sitting and looking at that patient in the eyes right then and there needs to be able to work autonomously with that patient. So that's what's missing.
So let me give you a classic example, and you tell me what you think of this. And by the way, folks listening, this is unrehearsed. Beth has not heard this before, so this is all sort of right on the spot here. But here's a classic example of what you're talking about that comes from my world, and it's a combination of, you know, regulations and EMR and all this kind of stuff. As you are no doubt familiar, that meaningful use, right, this set of rules and regulations which governs how physicians use their electronic medical records, it forces them to buy it in the first place and then forces them to use it in particularly stupid, non-productive ways. But one of the things that is in there is this requirement that if a patient reaches a certain level of obesity, a certain level of being overweight, which is measured by this thing called a body mass index, which the doctors all know what that is. It's a formula that takes your height and your weight and decides how fat you are based on a number. And it has certain limitations. It is by far, in a way, not a perfect measurement. But one of the requirements of meaningful use is that when your patient comes in and gives their height and you measure their height and you measure their weight and you come up with this number, that if this number exceeds an arbitrary value, and that number happens to be 30, which is a unitless, meaningless number, but let's just say it exceeds a certain number, then you are, as the physician, required by the quality reporting part of meaningful use to address that issue on the spot. You are required to give them some kind of handout. You're required to mention it and then click a button that says that you've mentioned it. And that's supposed to be somehow better care all by itself. Because of somebody's notion.
That's a perfect example where here's somebody coming in. I mean, as a ear, nose, and throat physician, you know, they're going to come in, they can't hear, or they've got this horrible ringing in their ears, and or something else. You know, I mean, it could be something much, much more disturbing is the patient's primary concern. And I'll tell you, people who are overweight don't enjoy that. That, you know, that's not a confidence builder. That's not something they feel good about. And to have to address that, no matter what the patient's priorities are, is totally insensitive. It absolutely goes against everything that you would be able to do. Even the best way to address this very sensitive issue for so many people is to first really establish a relationship of trust and mutual respect. And if you jump right into the issue of obesity, That's exactly the wrong way to go about it.
Absolutely. And that's the part when we talk about loss of autonomy, Beth, this is it. You know, no one gives you the physician, right? I mean, 15 years of training after high school and 20 years of experience after that. And I have a bureaucrat who wrote a rule somewhere telling me that when a patient comes in and says, gosh, you know, I'm having trouble swallowing, my voice has changed, I'm really worried I have cancer, and I have to walk in and go, hi, I'm Dr. Karuchak, did you know you're fat? And that's ridiculous. You know, I'm obviously going to note their obesity, and sometimes we see problems that are related to obesity. We see sleep apnea, right? And we see hypertension and diabetes and stuff where the obesity needs to be addressed. But, you know, part of our talent as physicians is to be able to finesse that a little bit. And just like you said 2 seconds ago, you know, give the doctor-patient relationship a chance to establish itself and grow, and give that patient a chance to learn to trust you before you say, okay, you know what, it's time we talked about the weight or the tobacco or whatever else is going on.
The other parallel with this, Mike, is that as physicians lose autonomy, so will patients. Right?
Of course they do.
And so it's not, so people can see this about a bunch of egotistical physicians who just want to be the boss. And they're whining now that they have to start considering other people's, you know, mandates and opinions. But it's not about that. It's about our ability to even advocate for the autonomy of our patients. An example in primary care is the use of vaccines. Now, I think vaccines are a wonderful invention, and my kid got every single vaccine that ever was, you know, has come out.
Yes.
I think they're great. I will also, would counsel people that on the importance of these vaccines, but it's up to the patient to decide. And if physicians start getting financially penalized for the patients choosing not to become vaccinated, what does that do? That destroys patient autonomy, and it absolutely disrupts the doctor-patient relationship.
Well, you can't have a doctor-patient relationship if you say, I'm acting as an agent of the government, and I'm telling you have to have this vaccine or else. When you go to talk about the next issue, where's the trust? I mean, it's just not going to be there.
Here's another place where the idea of autonomy, I think, is misunderstood. And maybe rather than using autonomy, we should talk about leadership, physician leadership, and the need for that. I work with medical students, and I hear the kinds of things that they're being instructed about, and some of it is really good. I mean, teamwork is great, but teams don't function well without leaders. And one of the things that physicians have done is really abdicate some of their leadership position, much of their leadership position, all in the name of teamwork. And this doesn't mean that I don't value what the other team members have to offer. That's, a leader doesn't discount the value of their team members. In fact, what a true leader will do is assist everybody in their team to be able to work at the top of their potential and help them grow. And yet, the buck has to stop somewhere. And there's certain places where it really needs to be the physician, because of not just the legal liability, but also the clinical expertise. The physician needs to be the one to make the final decision, not the hospital administrator, not the head of nursing, you know, not, of course you get input from this, and you work with your team members, and you treat them respectfully, and all that. But this idea of egalitarianism and sort of abdication of attempting to be a leadership and understanding what it means to be a leader, which is not dictatorial, autocratic, very different things.
Well,
and that's part of the autonomy, too.
Well, the problem
really
is
really building leadership.
The problem is, Beth, just like we see so many other places, the team concept is being used as a Trojan horse to completely change the nature of the healthcare system. We're already up on the first break, Beth. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay with us with special guest Dr. Beth Haynes.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards right here every Thursday morning at 9 with me, your hostess, Pat Rulo. Or listen to my podcasts at americaswebradio.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship.
I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, co-host of The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Please join us in the fight to save the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper and go to this website, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. Dr. Mike Karuchak here, hosting you in the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Thanks very much for joining us. Hopefully you can stay with us the entire hour. We've got a great show going on here. We have special guest Dr. Beth Haynes joining us before sunrise from the West Coast. And we are talking about the loss of physician autonomy. We are talking about the fact that the practice of medicine is under siege. It is under siege from the competitive stakeholders, that's what I call them, the competitive stakeholders in the healthcare system. That includes legislators, bureaucrats, hospitals, insurers, regulators, paper pushers, just about everyone that you can think of has decided that there is power to be gained and a buck to be made in the healthcare system, and it comes all at the expense of the patient and the physician's ability to take care of that patient. So, Beth, we were just talking about this Trojan horse concept, the fact that medical students, and I want you to sort of go off on the Benjamin Rush Institute and review that with everyone, but even from the early days of medical training, that medical students are being indoctrinated under the guise of learning team concept of something a bit more sinister.
Yeah, and again, it's just like physicians who are complaining about EMR, the electronic medical records, aren't Luddites. They aren't anti-technology. It's against the top-down imposition of these technologies that really are not patient-physician oriented, right? So same thing with saying there's a problem with all this emphasis on team. There's no problem with having teamwork. It's how it's being defined in this very egalitarian way, so that there's no distinguishing of who actually has the responsibility and accountability for various decision makings, and trying to make it so everybody's part of is treated completely equally in the decision making. And that's, the training doesn't lead to that. It doesn't make sense. And so again, rather than thinking about it as autonomy, I like to think it about as physician leadership, because leadership is not dictatorial, autocratic. You lead by assisting your team members to be the best they possibly can be, and you're one of them, and yet you're also taking on the responsibility and accountability in a way that others who aren't leaders are not doing. And physicians with their training are really in the place to do that. And I mentioned that, you know, I work with medical students. The Benjamin Rush Institute has chapters across the United States on medical campuses, and we bring in, help the students bring in speakers and have debates about healthcare policy and medical ethics. And particularly, we're interested in coming up with solutions to our healthcare challenges that protect the doctor-patient relationship. Not just because it's, you know, some idealistic thing, but because it's been shown through evidence that the doctor-patient relationship is the primary means of delivering quality medical care to patients. And the only way that we really can protect that is with a free enterprise system which also then fosters innovation and is the way that we're going to get the healthcare costs down. So those are the kinds of things that we have these students talk about. You're probably, and maybe your audience is really aware of some of the limitations that have been put on young physicians in training about the work hours. And you and I trained at a time where there were no limitations.
Yes, indeed.
Some of that was abused. Now we've swung the pendulum maybe too far the other way, and in a sense almost protecting the physicians in their training from some of the very stressful long hours that they're going to have to face as practicing physicians. And how do you gain that experience? There's real concern about that. So there's, again, not even being able to be in charge of our own, how do we train ourselves? How do we gain the skills and the expertise, the experience, including operating and making decisions while you're tired, being able to follow a case from the beginning to the end and really getting the full experience of someone coming in very sick and then everything that has to happen to be able to help them get better.
Absolutely.
Those decisions really have been taken away.
That's right, and I think there's sort of a subtle message delivered when that happens that says we're going to expect less from you when we train you, but then the flip side is we're going to demand that you give less and lead less when you get out, and that medicine's not a continuity of care concept anymore, that medicine's not a 24/7 sort of a paradigm in terms of what happens when patients get very sick, that it all becomes a matter of handing it off, and you know, when you're not there, you're really not there. I think there's been, and again, I was in some of the most brutal surgical residencies imaginable, and was some of that over the top? Yeah, a little of it was over the top. But the flip side is that, you know, what you learn, not only, you know, in terms of particulate knowledge and physical skills, but just the insight and the wisdom that comes from that kind of training. I mean, we almost sound like a couple of fuddy-duddies going, well, in my day, we used to work 80 hours, you know.
No, not really. It's also kind of the Hogwarts sorting hat, you know, but rather than just somebody magically putting this hat on, you need to go through some of that training and say, okay, am I up to that? Is this the kind of lifestyle I want? Am I able to actually function under the conditions that I need to be able to function to practice medicine? You know, so emergency medicine, you have to be able to juggle all sorts of things, and you really end up working pretty long hours, and if you're in the middle of the night, be able to wake up quickly, be instantly awake, and start thinking. Not everybody can do that. Not everybody has that physiology. And it's better to find that out in your years of training than to go through some pampered or less rigorous training. And then now you're the one where there is no backup. And now you're finding out you can't function underneath that. That's really frightening. They're also finding now with some studies that with the shorter hours, it's actually... The whole purpose of this was patient safety, is that it's increased the number of handoffs and turnovers.
Absolutely.
Which has actually increased the number of errors that are occurring. So it's a bit counterintuitive. Very important to keep following that, because nobody would have thought that was going to happen as far as patient safety goes. It'll also be very important to see how skilled the physicians are coming out of training. In particular, I think about this with surgeons, but for everybody, how many cases will residents have seen of the various really critically ill people that they need to be able to take care of? And if that goes down because of these restricted hours, in the long run, that's not going to serve patients.
Well, you're right. You get this subtle, and you said it better than I did. There's a subtle message there that says that nobody really takes ownership of an individual patient's case anymore. That it's not, you know, it's not your patient or my patient. They just get passed between the shifts. And so, you know, and that's kind of the fragmentation that we're seeing out in the healthcare system as things get, you know, homogenized and sanitized and corporatized and devalued, you know, that whole message is now starting very early.
Yeah.
So here's the epilogue, Beth, to the body mass index thing that I was telling you about. We were talking in the first segment, for those of you just joining us, about the meaningful use regulations, which, you know, require not only that doctors use medical records, but how they use them, and that, you know, if a patient's level of overweight state exceeds a certain threshold by an arbitrary calculation, we have to address that on the spot. So here's the electronic medical record health IT epilogue to that is, unbeknownst to us, this was not authorized by any physician in our practice, but our EMR, combined with our web portal, decided to take it upon itself to start sending secure emails to all of our patients who exceeded the obesity threshold.
Who programs that in there?
Well, the vendor did it, and we called them completely outraged. And they said, well, we have to do this because of meaningful use stage 2, so if you turn it off, you won't be meaningful use compliant anymore. I mean, can you believe that?
I mean, so your electronic medical record generates a communication, an email?
Yeah, it was because, you know, here's how the whole thing.
Directly to your patients without you being aware of it.
Yeah, you want to talk about loss of autonomy and control and loss of leadership? I mean, here's a howling example is that, we had patients just start calling us complaining that they're getting secure. I mean, the emails were secure. Gee, that's great. But based on the data in their record, they've been determined to be overweight. Please call your doctor to discuss further. Now, you want to talk about destroying the doctor-patient relationship.
Oh, my God.
I mean, and having no control. I mean, if a computer can do that, what else can it do? I mean, you know, what other unauthorized steps is it going to take?
And the way you found this out was your patients
called us back.
Somebody had the kindness to just not get absolutely miffed. And
well, some of them weren't so kind, and you know, some of them called pretty angry, and who can blame them?
They're angry, but they contacted you. How many patients would get so angry and insulted by that they would just say, okay, blame you as the physician, and say, I'm never going to that doctor, anybody who is this insensitive, and you had no clue that it was going on, and it would continue to go on? Oh my God.
I mean,
that is the
real world in the trenches manifestation of the utopian garbage that comes out of DC, right? Some bureaucrat sits on a panel or on a committee somewhere and says, gee, we need to address the obesity problem in this country. Oh, I know. We'll just make doctors deal with it. And we'll make them deal with it through their electronic medical record system, because isn't data wonderful in all forms, right? There's no way to hurt patients with computers, right? That we know that's mistaken. You know, we can't hurt patients with computers or data, so let's just open the spigot and make all this stuff come out. And then this is what happens. In order to comply with regulations, it's not our vendor's fault. I mean, they're doing, you know, what they're expected to do according to meaningful use regulations. But this is the kind of awful stuff that happens.
So here, this is part of the problem of what I see politically, and this is just absolutely crazy, that what is coming through healthcare policy is a whole slew, a theme behind this is they want to leverage medical care to solve problems that have nothing to do with medical care. And, you know, this whole thing about health of populations.
Yes.
And that doctors are going to have to pay attention to the health of populations, and therefore they're going to be pay for performance on how their populations, not on individual patients, but how their populations look on some statistical analysis.
And we'll pick it up in the next segment. Can you stick around for segment 3?
Yeah, you got me right in the middle, but I will.
Okay, good deal. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay with us with special guest Dr. Beth Haynes.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
I'm Pat Rulo, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my show, Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio, now on America's Web Radio, every Thursday morning at 9 a.m. following the Doctor's Lounge. Find out how you can stay safe during every healthcare or hospital encounter. We go where mainstream stops. Join me Thursday or listen to my podcasts on americaswebradio.com. For more information, visit speakupandstayalive.com.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We are back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for sticking with us. We have guest Dr. Beth Haynes. Because of the break, I almost had to cut her off mid-sentence. Sorry about that, Beth. Pick up where you left off.
Let's see if I can recapture it. So we were talking just about how inappropriate many of these healthcare policies. Perhaps I really do think they're well intentioned. I think people really see a huge problem of quality and access in our country, and they're trying to come up with ways to help it. But what they're doing is they've misdiagnosed what's going on, and so they've said doctors are the ones that have been in charge, and we need to clamp down on physician autonomy, physician ability to just think on their own, and we're going to start regulating all that. But they're trying to solve problems through medical care that are not fixable through medical care. It's like we were talking about, I was mentioning the health of populations. If you look at the data at what determines health, like you're talking about obesity, right, is a huge problem. There's only so much that access to medical care can do and medical treatment can do. Health determinants are much more influenced by things like education, income, and lifestyle. And if you look at what medicine can actually do to alter the health of populations, maybe we contribute 20% at the maximum, and probably only have 10% effect on really changing people's health. And yet everything is like this huge set of cannon shots that are all being aimed at the medical community and doctors in particular, trying to get them to leverage and change people's the health of populations. It's not going to work. It can't. You can't get somebody who only has 20% of the power, 10% of the influence to be able to change all that. So they're putting all this money, they're disrupting the doctor-patient relationship, they're disrupting people's relationship to their insurance companies and their hospitals and their specialists and all that, and it's not going to work. It's been misdiagnosed.
Well, and we're being misled, and I think that some folks, you know, in the upper echelons are deliberately misleading us on some of these things, and your thoughts make me think about what I heard for the umpteenth time at this health information technology meeting that I went to last week. And once again, we get somebody up behind the podium who rails on the fact that we spend, you know, between $8,000 and $9,000 per capita in this country on healthcare, and yet our life expectancy is no better and our infant mortality rate is no better. and they quote the same statistics that have been soundly debunked, in some cases by the people who actually, you know, wrote those statistics. And you know, those parameters, just like you're saying, Beth, are not a measure of a healthcare system's performance. I mean, you know, life expectancy is a combination of lifestyle and genetics, which are two things that, you know, as yet we really don't have a lot of control over.
It also is income and education. And so
yes,
many of those health determinants actually have to do with poverty. And the way to solve the problem is to more directly deal with the existence of poverty and lack of good education opportunities that people have. It's not a medical problem. So yeah, one of the things that the Benjamin Rush Institute is trying to do is really broaden that conversation for our physicians in training, our future colleagues, the people who are going to take care of us when we need them, right?
Yes.
And get them to understand that there are other alternatives out there than having this top-down, very government-centric solution, central planning solution to things. There's opportunity to really let civil society come up with solutions, creative, innovative entrepreneurs, medical entrepreneurs, come up with alternatives from the bottom up. This is the way we've solved world poverty, is by liberating people to come up with creative ideas. They have to make it or break it on their ideas, and the patients or the customers, in the case of other economic areas, get to choose what's of value to them rather than having value decided by a small group of politically powerful elite and imposing that upon the entire country. We really want to empower patients with education from a physician who is able to honestly deliver their best medical advice in that doctor-patient relationship and come up with what is the best treatment plan for people.
Well, it's got to be the patients who decide, you know, what quality of care is. It is,
yes,
not, as you said, you know, bureaucrats thousands of miles away. I mean, I was a patient a couple of months ago, right? Wiped out on my mountain bike, decided to go to the ER, be sure I wasn't badly hurt. You know, I went to the hospital where I work, so it's a little bit of an artificial situation. But, you know, my feeling is that, you know, I, as the patient, decided if I liked how I was treated there or not. And I went to St. Joe's, and they did great, and I'd certainly go back. But if they didn't, then I would be, you know, I would go somewhere else. And as a patient, and I'm not talking as a doctor for the next 2 seconds. I'm talking as a patient, and we will all be patients at some point in our lives, that I want to decide whether I got good care or bad care where I went. And I will vote with my wallet and my pocketbook and my feet when the next time is that care comes. I don't really care how many quality boxes my doctor's checked when he came in to see me. I wanted to know that he was nice, that they were pleasant, that they took care of my needs as I defined them, not how somebody else defined them. You know, now I'm getting all sorts of phone calls from my insurer wanting to know all sorts of goofy stuff, and I don't really feel like cooperating with them very much.
Here's another place where we're getting into trouble with physician leadership. If you have a physician who speaks up and starts saying, hey, this is not being done right, and pushes back against the administration, there's now this term disruptive physician.
Oh, yeah.
So, and of course you can be obnoxious about how you do it, and that's not good, right? But just for speaking up about some place where you see a quality lapse, you can be kicked off, lose your hospital privileges, get this ding against you that you're now a disruptive physician. Again, it's a matter of teaching our young physicians what is true leadership, what is it all about, giving them the skills of true leadership. And that's not just barking orders at people in any direction, right? And
absolutely,
yet also saying we as the, you know, the one that will bear the brunt of much of the responsibility for having bad outcomes, we should also get credit for good outcomes. We need to be able to be leaders, and we need to be able to make those decisions as physicians. But of course as a team, but not an egalitarian team without distinguishing various skills and who appropriately makes those decisions. And unless we can get those leadership skills to our medical students and our residents, we're really going to lose. they're being, you know, and if everybody's taught that, that it's bad to speak up and bad to speak out as a leader, that this is disruption, that you're not working well and playing with others.
That's right.
We're going to lose a significant voice for patients.
Well, and it's made worse, Beth, by this move to have physicians become employed by large institutions, whether it's a hospital or insurer or something else, because a lot of times these employment agreements, as I understand them, have some of these issues that you're talking about hardwired into contract language. And so they can hurt you even worse, right? I mean, they, you know, maybe they can curtail your privileges, but you could go to another hospital, but they, you know, in an employment agreement, they can just fire you.
They can, and I, you know, maybe physician employees is the way to go. I don't know. I would just like to have a level legal playing field so that we really let patients say which kind of physicians they would prefer to have, and for physicians to say what kind of physicians they would prefer to be employed or independent. Because I don't know. I don't think anybody knows which is the best system. But right now, the policies in place are rigged against the independent private practice physician and in favor of herding everybody into employment. Like I said, that may or may not be the best way to go, but let's duke it out on a level legal playing field. Don't have Washington policy wonks pick and win, you know, pick the winners and losers. Let the patients and the doctors be the ones that decide how medicine is best practiced.
Yeah, I've heard enough you know, horror stories about the employment model. I don't profess to totally know either, Beth, but you know, I hear these stories about, you know, physicians getting taken aside and saying, you know what, you're not admitting enough people. You're not ordering enough labs, right? You know, we have the situation where the institution, whatever that might be, is expecting to make a certain amount of money off that doctor based on referrals for labs, referrals to other specialists, you know,
sure,
admissions.
But the only reason they can get away with that is because it's become so regulatorily difficult to be an independent physician.
Correct.
And if there was a true level playing field, then that employed physician would have more power.
Well, they would have more power to stay
independent. I'm not going to take this. I'm going to go practice another way.
Right. But it's a monopolistic employment model because
yes,
to stay independent, you have to do all of these, you know, HIPAA, OSHA, meaningful use, you know, soon to be on your doorstep, MACRA kind of things. And so, you know, you finally, you know, to surrender to an employment model is to say, well, I have to outsource this. I can't, as an independent physician, maintain compliance with all of these hundreds of thousands of regulations. So I'm going to outsource my liability to
right.
an employer.
Right, right. So that's what I'm saying. It's because the lack of that. So I think if we had a true level playing field, that it wasn't so tipped in favor of driving everybody into employment model, then the employment model would have to improve. It would have to improve from the standpoint of the physician working there and their ability to advocate for their patients, because people wouldn't stay with it.
Agreed. And so, you know, yeah, and I have no problem, like you said, with an employment model existing in fair competition
yes.
with other sort of practice models, be it solo practice, group practice, single specialty,
absolutely.
Multi-specialty, right? I mean, there used to be a plethora of models that a doctor could consider when they were trying to figure out, you know, what sort of setting they wanted to work in. But, you know, that is rapidly going away in favor of, you know, I mean, it's happening at all levels, right? I mean, now we're down to three major private insurers across the country. So you're getting consolidation at all levels from, you know, physicians all the way up to insurers and hospitals. And so, you know, in the end, what happens? Well, prices go up, quality goes down, because nobody is competing with each other anymore. So, Beth, we're at the end of the third segment. I will not presume to hold you prisoner for another segment. So thanks very much for being with
us. I'm wide awake. I can just sit and listen to you if you want.
Well, okay. If you want to stick around, that would be fantastic, and just interject whenever you want to. You're listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Pat Rulo, hostess of Speak Up and Stay Alive, the voice for patient safety. Now heard every Thursday morning at 9 a.m. right here at AmericasWebRadio.com.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We are back once again. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchek. We still have Dr. Haynes with us, who's going to stick with us through the fourth segment, so thank you for that. And we're going to continue to move on. There's a couple of things that I promised some other folks at the Docs for Patient Care Foundation that I would cover by the end of the hour. So we're going to jump into those. But first I want to just make my usual plea at this point, which is, and you heard it on the break, which is to give generously, right? We have organizations like the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, like the Benjamin Rush Institute, which need your financial support. We can't do these radio shows. We can't do the things that we do behind the scenes to serve as almost the last line of defense for a doctor-patient relationship-based model of medical care. We are, you know, trying to defend against the siege that that practice of medicine is under from the competitive stakeholders, the hospital networks, the bureaucrats, the insurers, and all of these people who don't view healthcare as a way to make sick patients better. They view healthcare as just another business, as a way to distribute wealth and power to friends and deprive it from enemies. And this is the thing that we need to fight for, and we can't do it without your financial support. So at the break, you heard our website, docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Please go there and donate. We're a 501c3. It is a fully tax-deductible donation, so please give generously. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that the Benjamin Rush Institute has a similar website and a similar place that you can go. So give generously to both, and keep the mission alive, keep the dream alive, so that we can continue to do what we are doing. Thank you in advance for your donation.
Thank you.
Of course. So moving along, there was an article published. This was a labeled as a position paper by the American College of Physicians. A group I've not paid a whole lot of attention to up to this point, but they have published a horribly inaccurate, horribly misleading, irresponsible, stupid paper on direct primary care. And they have made a variety of intellectual mistakes. You almost wonder if some of them weren't deliberate. But I can't tell if they're evil or stupid. Hopefully they're just
evil.
Okay,
so Mike, what's the paper? I'm sitting in front of my computer and I want to look it up.
Yes, it's called Assessing the Patient Care Implications of Concierge, in quotes, and Other Direct Patient Contracting Practices. It's on annals.org. But basically what they've come out and said is that direct primary care is irresponsible. Again, we see another example of the failure of organized medicine to serve the people they claim to serve. Unfortunately, a rebuttal's been published. It's been published by Dr. Phil Eskew, who does a lot of writing on direct primary care. So a lot of my comments are based not only on the parent article, this position paper, but also on Dr. Eskew's comments. And unlike the American College of Physicians, I think Phil Eskew knows what he's talking about. So here's what happens in this position paper. The first thing they do wrong is they lump direct primary care practices with concierge practices. And I think we need to take this, those of us on our side of the issue need to take this as a wake-up call, that there's a lot of ignorance and a lot of misinformation out there about what direct primary care is and what it's not. Direct primary care is not concierge medicine. Concierge medicine is where you go to a physician and pay an extra $1,000 a year and $1,500 a year on top of your full featured, full coverage insurance for additional perks like your primary physician's cell phone number, like, you know, 24/7 access, coordination of care with specialists, et cetera, et cetera. I work with a couple of concierge docs. It's a good thing that they're doing because there's a demand for that kind of thing. And I don't think there's anything morally or wrong with that. But that's not direct primary care. Direct primary care is where, yes, you do pay money directly to a physician's practice, but there is no full-featured insurance. There is only a wraparound, catastrophic-only, high-deductible policy, which is far cheaper than the full-featured policy that you need to walk into a concierge doc with. And so it is not a elitist-only thing, direct primary care. It is not a, as this paper asserts, it is not a way to deny care to the poor, to deny care to the uninsured, to deny care to those that have expensive pre-existing conditions like diabetes and heart disease and hypertension. It is, in fact, a better way to deliver care to those patients because they can get the care that they need and they can get access to a primary care physician far more cheaply in a direct primary care model, which allows a patient to access a doctor for the cost of a cell phone, right? $50 a month, and it will get you a basic, care package. But the visits are virtually unlimited. I mean, it's 24 visits a year. That would be a visit more than once every 2 weeks. And even if you have diabetes or hypertension, it's unlikely you'll need to visit the doctor more than that. And in fact, there are some good data out there, ignored by this American College of Physicians paper, that shows that people in a direct primary care practice visit their primary doctor more often and visit emergency rooms and other similar clinics less often. So it's exactly the effect that you want, to decrease utilization of the most expensive care, increase utilization of the far more cost-effective care. And yet all this paper can talk about is that direct-to-primary care reduces access, that's a lie, drives up costs, that's wrong, avoids care of minorities, impoverished individuals, that's wrong, there's no data to suggest that, and suggests that there's a hidden potential for increased out-of-pocket costs. There's only one thing that this position paper gets right, and that is that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, does allow this model. It specifically allows a model where you can pay directly into a primary care physician's practice and have a wraparound in insurance. And in fact, I think in some states you can even purchase that insurance through an exchange, through an Obamacare exchange. So, Obamacare supports this. I mean, I'm not saying that's necessarily a good thing, except to say that the folks that are on the other side of most of the other issues in healthcare think this is a good thing. And clearly, in our experience with Dr. Gross and the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, we have discovered through our own direct experience the appeal, the bipartisan appeal of a direct-to-primary care model. And so for this paper to come out and say all of these, non-truths, I don't know if they're just lies or they're mistakes, to suggest that direct-to-primary care, increases costs, reduces access, avoids care of minorities and people with chronic conditions, is just flat-out wrong. And I agree with Dr. Eskew's rebuttal that says that they should be embarrassed. I mean, the American College of Physicians ought to be embarrassed that they put something out like this because it is such a huge mistake. You know, their literature search was horrible. All right? They had no peer-reviewed sources no sources from peer-reviewed medical literature. Their sources were, you know, Forbes magazine, which is fine, but it's not peer-reviewed medical literature. You know, they had, you know, USA Today. They had, you know, stuff in here that has nothing to do with, you know, peer-reviewed medical articles. You know, Kevin MD, The Hill, you know, Time Magazine, U.S. News and World Report, not USA Today, that was a mistake, but you know, lay sources for all of their information, and that's ridiculous, because there's plenty of peer-reviewed literature out there. Dr. Eskew has plenty of those cited in a recent article that he published, and you can see that, yes, clearly, you know, direct-to-primary care provides a more cost-effective model to provide care to folks who otherwise can't afford to get insurance. And then the last thing they say, and Beth, just weigh in on this and tell me what you think. And again, I'm putting Beth on the spot here. See, she was foolish enough to stick around for the fourth segment, so now I'm going to put her on the spot. That they talk about a professional obligation, that the direct to primary care is a violation, or at least is a risk to our professional obligation to serve all who need care, and that that somehow, you know, direct to primary care sort of violates that concept.
So one of the places where direct primary care may look like they're not serving as many people is because many of the physicians doing this have smaller patient panels.
Yes.
You know, instead of seeing having 5,000 patients that identify them as their doctor, they may have 1,000. And so you can look at those numbers. But what's happening is there's many physicians who would probably be quitting the practice of medicine because of some of the loss of autonomy that we talked about earlier in this program.
Yes.
Are staying in practice because they're reclaiming the kind of practice that they really want. And instead of becoming a patient mill where you've got 7 to 8 minutes to see a patient, because that's what you need to be able to do to service 5,000 patients. Primary care, direct primary care is able to set up visits of any length that the patient actually needs in order to address the problems of that patient. The charging mechanism is such that you don't have to bring patients back at their inconvenience multiple times in order to be able to make your billing.
Yes.
So you can actually provide the kind of care and service that suits the convenience of the patient as well, and deal with multiple problems in a single visit. And you don't have to worry about the fact that you're only going to get paid for one problem. So there's a lot of that where if you look at just the numbers, it may seem like patients have, you know, the doctors are servicing fewer patients, but the quality of what they're doing and the fact that they're staying in practice, we're actually preserving patient access to physicians.
And I think it's happening at the other end of the medical career as well, right, Beth? I mean, medical students will probably find primary care far more appealing to go into if they know there's a financial model that they can survive.
So one of the things that's been happening is Josh Umber from Atlas MD has been basically doing a tour of all the Benjamin Rush Institute chapters throughout the country, and he is setting the students on fire. There are people saying, boy, I never would have thought about primary care. But now that I've met Dr. Josh, and I heard about his practice model, this is exciting. This is what medicine is all about. Caring for patients is why I became a physician, and this is a model that will really let me be able to do it in a way that feeds my soul and will, in that way, keep them in the practice of medicine for much longer.
So we end on believe it or not, we are at the end.
Okay.
We are at the top of the hour, believe it or not. Beth, thank you so much for staying for the entire show. Folks, you guys got a great experience here with Dr. Beth Haynes helping me out. So you have been listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. See you next week.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.